My contribution, your contribution, is to counter that. To counter the disease that gets in the way of this goal that we all have, which is healthy longevity. It's just those two words, Rob. We're all pursuing healthy longevity.
That was Roderick Pettigrew, who served as founding director of the National Institute of Biomedical Imaging and Bioengineering from 2002 through 2017. Pettigrew, who has an MD and a PhD in applied radiation physics, wrote his PhD thesis on how a controlled nuclear reaction in the brain, boron neutron activation therapy, could be used to treat glioblastoma multiforme. Then he got to thinking, could he combine his basic science background with medicine? Pettigrew went on to work in the field before becoming a resident in nuclear medicine at University of California, San Diego. There, he became a self-taught expert on an emerging technology, nuclear magnetic resonance imaging, or the MRI. Today, Pettigrew serves as Chief Executive Officer of Engineering Health and inaugural Dean for Engineering Medicine at Texas A&M University in partnership with Houston Methodist Hospital. In this conversation, Pettigrew speaks with Robert Wynn, guest editor of the Cancer History Project during Black History Month, about his discoveries, approach to science and medicine, and how he came to be the founding director of the NIBIB.
So, Dr. Pettigrew, I just want to say thank you so much for agreeing to be able to talk to you really about your contributions in science, which have been numerous and of high impact. But can you start me off? Listen, how did you even get, and who inspired you to even become a doctor? I mean, how did that get on your radar?
Rob, I have to tell you, I've reflected on this a bit. And I have said before, and I'll say now, and I'll probably say the same thing in the future, because it really is the truth. I think I came out of the womb as a scientist.
And hold on. Explain. That needs some explaining.
I mean, as far back as I can remember, I've just always been thrilled and excited and motivated and inspired by discovery and just understanding the why and how things work and the way things are the way that they are. And the more that I learn, the more fascinated I've become by the element of unity and consistency throughout nature, and how interrelated everything is, and how much it all, once you understand it, makes sense. How it cuts across disciplines, this thing called life, you know, that we have. It's a seamless blending of all of the sciences and engineering are seamlessly interwoven in this thing called life. In fact, if you didn't have biochemistry, biology, genetics, physics, engineering, there wouldn't be life. I mean, life is that. It's a manifestation of all of that. And there's just no boundaries in human biology, physiology, or health and disease. There's just no separations of all of these disciplines. So I think from an early age, I was really just fascinated by understanding. And whenever a new subject was coming up, I was just excited because I thought, man, I'm going to learn more about how things work and about how life works. I remember being fascinated at an early age when I discovered that many of the things that you bought in a store, you could actually make yourself. I go, whoa, because, you know, you think that these things that, these mystery items that you have, like a vacuum cleaner, for example, is something is just fascinating, that the fact that you could have this thing, that you rub it across the rug and it picks up dirt and so forth without really understanding the principles behind it. And then once you do, you go, oh, that's not so mysterious. You know, I really know how it works. And that sort of understanding emerged both from the classroom, but also from experience in doing and making things. A simple thing like a kite, which I first bought as a kid, and my neighbor across the street, who was in the military, said, well, I see you flying kites. I actually make kites, and we can make these large kites. And you might want to have some fun. I said, you can make a kite? So he goes, oh, yeah, just get two thin rods or weeds and tie them together, and we'll cover them with this paper that we have, and you put a tail on the end to sort of anchor it, and the wind will catch it, and it goes up. And I go, well, it has to be small enough to fly. And he goes, well, airplanes are big and they fly. And I thought, whoa, there is something to that. So we actually started out making kites that were, as a kid, that were bigger than me physically. We'd fly them. He had this big 5 foot wide roll of industrial wrapping paper. He had a big roll in his garage. We'd roll it out and take cut a big strip of it, get these two.
And this was in your neighborhood?
Yeah, it was my across the street neighbor. He was actually in the military. And Rob, I got to tell you, this was not a high-end neighborhood. The house that I grew up in, no joke, my father drove us. It was three kids. I was in the middle. So he drove me to this neighborhood one Saturday. And he said, this is in Albany, Georgia. They're going to be building five houses on the street. And they had cleared out this patch of land. And we're gonna move into one of these houses, or I'm thinking about us moving into one of these houses. At the time, we were living in a rented apartment, the family. So we drove over. He showed us this tract of land that had been cleared. They had started to kind of mark off where these five houses would be. And no joke, Rob, we came back the next weekend and all five houses were built and up in 1 week. This is no exaggeration. You're talking about prefab on a slab. Now, at the time, it didn't faze me. I mean, I was like 5 years old, 4 years old, 5 or 6 years old. I just figured that's the way it was. But in retrospect, it's amazing, man. So I grew up in this house that was literally built in 1 week. I laugh about it because I said we had original central heating. I had no air conditioning.
Oh, no.
And the central heating was this one gas stove in the middle in the wall that was the mid wall of the house that divided the sleeping half of the house and the living half of the house. The whole thing probably was no more than, I would guess, 1,200 square feet, you know, something like that. Wow. But you had this one vented gas heater in the middle, because we would all get up in the morning and go stand by the heater to get warm. And then my mother would cook breakfast and we'd stand in front of the oven to get warm. I mean, she'd put some bread in the oven and toast it, and we'd open the door. And but that was sort of my early early childhood, but it was certainly marked by scientific investigation and discovery.
And was your mom and dad like really, or did you have your mom, dad, brothers, sisters? Who drove you to that? Because it seemed like, you know, man, you got a good start.
Oh, I got a great start. So in that sense, you know, it was a blessing. You know, it was a very, very modest neighborhood, as I just described. But I was fortunate that I had parents, both of whom had gone to college. Exactly. And that's where they met.
And what years, I mean, was this around?
This was in the 60s.
60s, got it.
So they were, they met as students at Fort Valley State University in Georgia during World War II. And my father, who came from a financially very poor family, but the family was rich in terms of brother and sisterly love and support. And one of the things that they really did value was learning and knowledge and education. And I got that from them. My father was the youngest of seven, and all of his sisters and brothers, I think, well, he finished, went to college and finished. He was one of only two of them who did, but all of them were very supportive. And anytime I'd finished anything of any value, I always got a great round of applause from across the family.
Come on.
And if I get an A, my father would send a note to his brothers and sisters. He got an A. And then they would all write back, whoa, he got an A. And they would, you know, I had one uncle that would send me a $2 bill, my father's older brother. I don't think they make those anymore, but seriously, send me a $2 bill. All right, keep those A's coming. Then it got to the point where I was, you know, consistently making A's, and he would say A's and B's, and I would say B's. I don't make any B's. You know.
Oh my goodness!
But great, great, great family support. Then in the sixth grade, Rob, I was fortunate to have a marvelous science teacher, Mrs. Burke. And I told you that I was fascinated by kites and kind of, you know, wondered how planes as big as they are could get in the air and fly and so forth. And so one day in my sixth grade science class, Mrs. Burke walked in and she said, "Boys and girls, today we're going to learn about the Bernoulli principle." This was a pivotal point for me. It just preceded, it was around about the time of the space race and the Apollo program. And so she came and she said, "We're going to learn about the Bernoulli principle." And we all listened, and I, first time I ever heard the word Bernoulli. And she said, "You know, Bernoulli principle is something that you all are familiar with, although you never heard about it before." She said, "Bernoulli principle explains how birds fly, how planes fly, how anything that flies, flies." And she goes, "When you see a bird fly, that's a Bernoulli principle in action. When you see one of those big multi-ton steel planes up in the air, that's a Bernoulli principle in action." Hmm. And so with that, she had my 100% attention, and attention all along. So then she said, "Okay, Bernoulli principle governs fluid and fluid flow. And air is a fluid, water is a fluid, blood is a fluid, air is a fluid. And when fluid moves, it exerts less pressure than when it doesn't move. And the faster it moves, the less pressure it exerts. Then she went to the class, the front of the classroom, and on the chalkboard, drew the shape of the wing of a bird and the wing of an airplane. And it had this airfoil shape, curved on the top, flat on the bottom. She said, okay, here's the shape of the wing of a bird. And here's also the shape of the wing of an airplane. On the top, there is this curve. On the bottom, it's flat. As the wing of the bird or the plane moves through the air, air goes over it and under it. Because of the curvature on the top, the distance is greater. So the air just speeds up and it travels faster on the top than it does under the bottom. Because of the Bernoulli principle, the faster moving air on the top has less pressure than the air on the bottom. There is a difference in pressure. High pressure on the bottom, low pressure on the top. What happens? It lifts. It lifts up to the top. And that's where the lift comes from. That's how birds fly. That's how planes fly. Bernoulli principle. I was like, Rob, I was like, wow. Now I know why birds fly. I know how they fly. I know how planes fly. And I understand this. I mean, I'm like, my mom, we lived about three miles from the school. And typically I would walk, but that day my mother picked me up from school and we had an old Pontiac. They don't make Pontiacs anymore. But we had one of those
Pontiac
old
was a ride back in the day though.
We had an old Pontiac two-door car in front and back, but you know, it was a sedan two-door. So she picked me up and I got in the back seat and it had those crank windows where you have to crank the windows up.
Yes, sir.
And so I got in the back and I had some of my papers with me. But before I could crank up the window all the way, she takes off. And when she takes off, one of the pages that I had flies out of the window as she's driving. And then I said to my mother, it hit me. I know why that happened. It's Bernoulli principle. There's air on the outside. It's moving fast. There's less pressure on the outside relative to the inside. I go, whoa, that's why the paper went out the window. And I was like, oh man, Bernoulli principle. when my mother pulls out and the paper flies out, and I said, hey, Mom, I go, Mama, I know why the paper flew out of the window. She said, you didn't roll up the window quick enough. I said, no, I know why. I know why it flew out. So I go, it's a Bernoulli principle. And I start explaining to her. So then we get home and I used to have this race with my mother. I would try to get all my homework done before she could cook dinner. And if I could get it done before cooking dinner, I could eat dinner and then I could go out and play. Wow. So that was sort of like an internal race. So I'm in my room doing my homework. And then she says, I need you to vacuum the rug. Well, we didn't have carpet. We did have a rug. So I need you to vacuum the rug, before dinner. So I go in and I'm vacuuming the rug and it's sucking up. And I went, whoa, Bernoulli principle. That's how this thing works. And so it just hit me, Rob. I go, okay, there's a motor inside of this. It's whirling around. It's spinning the air. The air is moving fast. It has less pressure on the inside of the cleaner than the outside. That's where the suction comes from. And that hit me. That was like a six-year-old kid. And I was going like, whoa, this is amazing, man.
Wow.
So it goes like understanding all of these things around us that we interact with in life and how they work and this fundamental principle at play and applying principle to situations and problems and problem solving. That concept, which is the core of science, scientific innovation, got me at a young age, and I've just been on this journey ever since, Rob.
But how you keep that going? You know, now listen, you're a young brother. You having to get through both high school and college. How did you keep that interest, particularly through high school and college? And how did that actually shape you to take the next step that says, well, you know what? I need to go to med school.
Well, because it continued in high school. I just, you know, an opportunity to learn more and more and more. And then by the time you got to college, which was at Morehouse, you start interacting with the real world and real world problems. And you could see that you have an opportunity to have an impact on other people's lives. Mm. And in fact, we were challenged to do that at Morehouse. It was held out as an expectation. So one of the great things about Morehouse was that this environment and culture of expectation of accomplishment, expectation of contribution to humankind. It wasn't that you can do great things. It was, we expect you to do great things.
Wow.
You are expected to do. That came from Benjamin Mays, who I just brushed up against. He had just retired, but he would still come on campus from time to time. And that attitude, that culture was strong and pervasive. There is this statement where they say that Morehouse holds a crown above the heads of his students and challenges you to grow, to be substantial enough to wear it.
Wow, man, that is deep. So listen, that is deep. So as you're going through Morehouse, because this is how all of a sudden, all right, so you got the challenge, you get through Morehouse, and all of a sudden you're like, all right, then I'm going to do med school, MIT, you know, Texas. How does that work?
Yeah, so it evolved. So initially I went there as a scientist, as a physicist. So I was a physics major at Morehouse.
Ah, okay.
The chair of the physics department at Morehouse was a graduate of MIT. Morehouse, it was a small college, and it had like 2,000 students when I was there in the 70s. The physics department was small. There was only four or five of us in the whole department as majors. And so there were three teachers. The chair was a graduate of MIT, James Mayo. And the other key person who was there, Sam Neff, was a graduate of Harvard. So he was a physicist who came from Harvard, who was interested in Morehouse. I never really asked him why. He's still alive, Rob, and we've stayed in touch over the years, because he was such a devoted professor. He wasn't just someone who taught classes. he actually had a relationship with the students in the class. I literally, several of us would literally go to his house after class hours, sit on in his kitchen at the kitchen table and work through physics problems.
Come on, man. Him.
And his wife would bake cookies and bring them out, and we'd have we work physics problems on the kitchen table. And he was a Phi Beta Kappa Harvard grad. So Harvard Phi Beta Kappa, and that's where I got my physics training from these guys, but particularly him. Sam Neff was very engaged with me and was influential. So I told him that I had this interest of applying nuclear physics because over the 4 years that I was there with progressive courses, when we started getting into quantum mechanics and nuclear, I go, this stuff is really neat. We should be able to apply this to healthcare. In fact, that was starting to evolve. This concept of nuclear medicine was starting to evolve. And he was just very encouraging and said, we could apply this to all sorts of things. I had a member of our church who had been in the military, was a dentist, and he was talking about advances in dentistry. And I mentioned this to Sam Neff, and he said, yep, you could do that. But he said, if you're going to do it, think about the whole body. There's just problems from head to toe. It's not just the mouth, everything. And I go, oh, yeah, that's right. So as I finished Morehouse, my interest in and goal was in using physics, particularly nuclear physics, to address healthcare problems. And that eventually led me from undergraduate school to graduate school to medical school to the position, the first position I had post completing my medical training. Well, I'm skipping ahead now because I'm looking at the clock.
And where'd you go? So you went to med school and then grad school?
When I finished Morehouse, when I was at Morehouse, by the way, I went to Morehouse early. I have to tell you this. I did not finish high school. I got a scholarship when I was in 11th grade from Charles Merrill, who was the head of the investment firm Merrill Lynch. So I was a Merrill scholar. And Charles Merrill was at that time chair of the board of trustees of Morehouse. And each year he would pay for six Morehouse students to study abroad. And it was, you had to apply for and compete for the scholarship. So I did. And I was fortunate to have been selected as one of those. So I got a Merrill scholarship to go abroad. I also got a Merrill scholarship to come to Morehouse early, which is the other thing he did too. So he did each year he would pay for two students to come to Morehouse early if they met certain academic markers and levels. So I left Monroe High School in Albany, Georgia, after the 11th grade, went to Morehouse as a Merrill Scholar, as an early admissions Merrill Scholar. While there, I applied for and was awarded a Merrill Overseas Study Travel Scholarship. So Charles Merrill paid for my whole education.
Wow.
Which, afterwards I wrote him the most sincere a letter note of thanks and then updated him along the way when I was at NIH and I had started and founded the National Institute of Biomedical Imaging Bioengineering. I wrote him a letter saying, I want you to know the payoff in your investment in me, and here's what I'm doing now. And to my surprise, Rob, at the age of 90, he wrote me back.
No.
A handwritten letter.
No.
Yes. And it was about, I got it about a week later, and it was hilarious because it started out by saying, I'm so sorry it's taking me so long to respond to you. It was like a week later. He said, but I just been so busy with business deals. This is in his 90s.
So we can aspire to be. So listen, you're going to have to back this up for a minute. So, and I ain't going to let you go on this one. You helped create at the NIH that whole biomedical imaging, bioengineering sort of
center. I was a founding director.
So what gives? How did that even come about? How did it happen? How'd you make? Because that's important to note, because I know you being all humble about this, but usually people don't walk in and then they're able to create something, particularly with that impact.
No.
How did that happen?
So I'll explain that, but I want to tell you that there is a common thread in my whole professional life, and I've laid the groundwork for it already. And that is this concept of converging the physical sciences, which is where I started out as a physicist with the Bernoulli principle, a physical sciences, the life sciences, and engineering. And the engineering comes in because I wanted to take those scientific principles and understanding and medicine and converge them all into something that was socially meaningful and valuable and impactful. And that is the other key theme in my young life, from my family, my extended family. I mentioned all of my father's brothers and sisters, and also my mother, who had a brother and a sister. In fact, the two families were very much blended, but I very much came from a home where concern for your fellow man was continuously emphasized. So it was that combination of coming out of the womb as a scientist and having a family where they always talked about advancing the well-being of others and contributing to the well-being of others. And both of those things came together in this convergence of physics, engineering, and medicine.
Can I tell you, Dr. Pettigrew, how unique that is? And I'm going to frame it this way. We have people struggling right now trying to say, well, what as a basic scientist do I have to do with anything? And what you just done in a wonderful way of describing this is that even physics, which is the most basic, is that there is humanity and the understanding of how to use and harness that for the good of mankind. And so I hear lots of colleagues, and it doesn't matter where I'm at, NIH, Stanford, Kansas, you know, wherever I am, there is always this chief complaint. Well, all I do is science. It has nothing really to do with. And what you're telling me is that.
Oh, bull. Yes. Baloney. It has everything to do. It has everything to do with it. Man. I mean, at the end of the day, what are we trying to do? Wrong.
Expand on that.
Well, what is this all about? What we're all trying to do is to live healthy and long lives. That's what we're trying to do, man. Healthy, and health means health as we think of it, you know, our bodies work, but also happiness and, you know, social belonging and fulfillment, all of that. And you want to have that as long as you can. And so in order to do that, you have to understand these things that get in the way of that. Disease is one of them. So my contribution, your contribution, is to counter that. To counter the disease that gets in the way of this goal that we all have, which is healthy longevity. It's just those two words, Rob. We're all pursuing healthy longevity, no matter whether we're geneticists, basic biologists, biochemists, nanoscientists, imagers, artificial intelligence designers. If you're working in the health arena and the science and health arena, whether it's VCU or NIH or where I am now, InMed, engineering medicine, all of us are trying to achieve this goal of global planetary healthy longevity.
I love that. I wanted to ask about where you are right now and what you are doing.
Let me try to make this cohesive. So, you know, I talked about coming out of the womb as a scientist. I talked about being in a family where concern for your fellow man was always there. This was nurtured in high school when I got to Morehouse, and we were instilled with this belief that we can not only can, but expected to make a difference in this world. And my focus then was on bringing the physical and the life sciences together to help achieve healthy longevity. So I go to MIT by way of RPI, specifically to work on engineering and nuclear physics applications to healthcare problems. Mm. My PhD thesis at MIT, after earning a master's in nuclear science and engineering at RPI, because they had a program, they had just, the year that I graduated, they started a program in nuclear, in medical physics, which is the reason I went there. And when I was there, I learned about this work that was being done at MIT. So I transferred to MIT, and that's where I got my PhD, working on a treatment for glioblastoma multiforme. That's what my PhD thesis was on.
Okay.
It used a controlled nuclear reaction in the brain using a technique known as boron neutron activation therapy, in which you selectively load a boron 10 compound into brain tumors. Brain tumors don't have a blood-brain barrier, so they selectively uptake an injected substance, in this case, boron 10. The boron 10 atom, when exposed to neutrons, absorbs in its nucleus a neutron and becomes boron 11.
Mm-hmm.
The boron 11 isotope, unlike the boron 10 isotope, which is stable, boron 11 is highly unstable and radioactive and fissions. And when it fissions, it breaks apart, and the two fission fragments have a lot of energy, the same amount of energy per atom as in an atomic bomb, because atomic bomb releases energy by nuclear fission.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a nuclear fission process. These two fragments are charged, and because they are heavy, a alpha particle, which is the nucleus of helium, and a lithium particle, don't travel far in tissue. Because they're large, their range in tissue is small. How small? 10 microns. 10 microns, that's like about the diameter of a cell. So that means that you got this explosion limited to this tiny cell size diameter.
Wow.
Therefore, it is a particularly very localized explosion. And that was the appeal for boron-neutron capture therapy. So I went to MIT. So when I first read about this, I was like, wow, man, this is another Bernoulli moment, you know? It's like, whoa, this could really make a difference. So I went to MIT specifically to work on that project. I did. My PhD thesis was on it. That was in the 70s. My thesis advisor was the founder of the physics research lab at Mass General Hospital. I was in Mass General Hospital all the time. That gave me exposure to the medical environment. I actually worked on another problem as well that had to do with osteoporosis detection, also using neutron activation analysis. And through that, it was so satisfying, Rob. I said, I love this stuff. I could be more effective if I knew medicine firsthand. So while I was finishing my PhD thesis, I learned about an accelerated MD program for those who already had a PhD. It was an experimental program at the University of Miami. If you already had a PhD, they would accelerate you through medical school in 24 months. Six wow. days a week, nonstop, no days off. So I finished my PhD, defended my thesis. And then 2 weeks after that, I drove down to Miami and drove from Boston to Miami, started medical school. I entered this accelerated program. It was a small program, like 30 students. All of the students already had PhDs in a range of scientific fields, from biochemistry to biology to pharmacy to, you know, nutrition. We had one mathematician and a couple of us physicists. And so I finished that, which is another story. That was, whew, man, what? It's one of those things where you go, I'm glad I did it, but I wouldn't do it again. I had one day every 2 weeks, I took off 2 hours on Sunday to go grocery shopping. That was it. Man. For 2 years. That was my whole social thing. 2 hours of grocery shopping every 2 weeks. So I finished that. I went there expecting that I would go into radiation therapy. But when I saw the day-to-day life of a radiation therapist, it didn't really quite mesh with what my thinking was. So I started out in internal medicine. I went to Emory as an intern. I was an internal medicine intern, straight internal medicine intern at Emory. And Emory is just sort of great basic, you know, internal medicine training, just working in Grady Hospital. But after about my 30th GI bleeder, and my 50th chest pain and so forth, I go, okay, I kind of understand how to do this now. I want to get back to using some of my physics to help problem solve. So I applied for a residency fellowship at UC San Diego in nuclear medicine, and I did. Transfer to UC San Diego in that. And then about that time, that started to begin these discussions about this new diagnostic technology called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging, now known as MRI. In the beginning, it was NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, which is the more accurate term. And nothing was known about it. But with the background that I had in physics, I was able to teach myself, and I sort of became self-educated as a resident at UC San Diego. I was self-taught on MR. actually gave talk to the point where I started giving talks on MR. It was just emerging. And once I finished my training, I worked for 1 year in industry for the first manufacturer of MR equipment, which has been bought out by Philips, but it was called Picker at the time. They were first in MR. They were based in the UK. They had an office in the US. I worked as a clinical research scientist for them. And I developed the first cardiac imaging software for them, personally installed that software on the first 10 MR scanners made by Picker, sold and installed by Picker worldwide. I personally, physically went there, installed a software, which was a software that I had written, calibrated it, and then taught the radiologists and cardiologists how to use it.
Wow.
And then, and about that time, then I got a career development award from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So I'm a RWJ, Robert Wood Johnson Amos Foundation. It was actually the first cohort of those fellows. And I used that to go to Emory, started as an assistant professor, continued my work on cardiac imaging, continued to develop four-dimensional and quantitative flow imaging in the heart, became known for that. And as a result of that, was recruited by the NIH to start the new institute that had been mandated by Congress. And this institute fit my training so well because it was an institute to accelerate the quantitative and life sciences to advance biomedical technologies. That was NIBIB, National Institute of Biomedical Imaging and Bioengineering. I was recruited to start that institute, and I did. That was in 2002, and built that up from scratch. It did not exist before. It had not been an office the way some institutes start out as an office. And in fact, the truth, Rob, is that it was openly opposed by the NIH. And they told me that when I got there. They said the acting director then, who was Ruth Kirstein, who followed Harold Varmus. Harold Varmus and I are actually good friends now, but he similarly told me, I spent a lot of time opposing your institute. And I said, yes, Harold, I read about that. But the reason for that, Rob, is that the NIH gets a budget, and then that budget is divided among all of the institutes and centers at the NIH by Congress, where each institute has a line item. It gets its own budget, but it's all rolled up into a composite overall NIH budget. And I think that the other institutes and the NIH leadership at that time didn't want another mouth at the table.
Yes, makes it because it would apparently make the pie smaller, right? The bites would
be I mean, it's a zero-sum game. And so that was understandable. And there were these arguments about, we have engineering already in some of the institutes. We have imaging already in some institutes. But the external community, both the imaging community and the bioengineering community, had lobbied Congress strongly because there was not an institute that focused on the science and development of these technologies and innovations as a field to advance these things that actually catalyze advances in the basic sciences. And in fact, the truth of the matter, Rob, is there's a lot of back and forth and give and take. You know, you invent something new and that allows you to make a discovery. And you make a discovery and you get a better understanding. You said, I understand this, but I still don't understand part of it, but it's still part of it I don't understand. I need something that shows me and reveals the science to me with greater clarity. And you go back and you refine your tools and your technology. And there's all this back and forth and back and forth. The so-called Pasteur's quadrant, which is use-inspired basic science and discovery and technologies, is where we operated. And this institute, NIBIB, captured that domain and is now, I would say, the signature institute for technological advances and advances in technology that catalyze our understanding and consequently catalyzes progress that we make in problem solving and making advances. You don't make advances without technological innovation. And this is a technological innovation institute. So I spent 15 years there doing that. It was critical, for example, during COVID. There was the basic science that had been developed for 15, 16, 17 years prior to the realization of the vaccine. And while Carrico and Weissman had demonstrated that in principle, you could instruct a cell to make a protein of interest, like the spike protein, you needed the technology to deliver the mRNA into the cell. And that required engineering a lipid, an ionizable lipid nanoparticle that would function much like a Trojan horse, that would take this instruction biologic into the cell, release it, and have it do its thing. And without that, we wouldn't have a functional vaccine. You'd still have a laboratory principle that you demonstrate, like, yeah, mRNA can if you get it into a cell, it can tell the cell what to make, and you can make the protein of your choice. But how to convert that into something that practically works, that you can inject into a person, required engineering at the nanoscale.
Mm.
And that was part of our domain and helped contribute to that, as was the case with home-based diagnostics. You know, another interesting thing, Rob, while I was at the NIH, we started this national network for developing point-of-care technologies.
Yes.
Called POCTER, which was actually leveraged by my successor quite successfully to spur the industry of home-based COVID diagnostics. And we had proposed this, I had proposed it along with the Gates Foundation. There is a scientist at Gates Foundation, his name is Dan Wattendorf. He and I had had a couple of meetings when I was at the NIH where we expressly laid out as a goal the development of what I call, what we both call, a home pregnancy test for the flu. So, you know, before COVID, the only really home-based diagnostic we had was for pregnancy. And you didn't have this diagnostic that would tell you if you had a viral infection. You had something that you could look at and tell whether or not you were pregnant. So we go, Wouldn't it be, it still would be great if you had something like that to tell you whether or not you have a garden variety annual flu. And in fact, my wife was just asked me recently, why is it that applied for the flu? Because we all get these sniffles and colds and stuff, but you don't know whether you have the flu or COVID or something else. And I go, absolutely. In principle, this could be done. We had hypothesized and held this out as a goal in the 2015 or so, somewhere in that time frame. It was a joint effort by NIBIB, my institute, and the Gates Foundation. What we did not have was the concentrated funds that came as a result of a congressional action when COVID hit, and this became such a national priority that there was this large amount of federal funding placed in this testing basket, and the NIH was asked to support and help develop diagnostics for COVID. And with that focus, with the resources to do that, my old institute, NIBIB, leveraged this network that we had created called POCTERN, Point of Care Technology Research Network. That's what POCTRN stands for. That network was engaged. There were several academic institutions that had already been working on developing point of care and home-based diagnostics. And that was engaged, and it said, go after this COVID diagnostic. And all of the basic science was there. You know, we knew the antigen itself, you know, the sequence for the antigen, you know how to make the antigen. So it was a matter of putting all of these pieces together to develop what is functionally the equivalent of a home pregnancy test for COVID.
That is so cool. You know what? That is so cool.
Another thing I will say, so I did this for 15 years at NIBIB. And then I got a call from Texas A&M, which that said, we have been thinking about creating a new concept medical school that would converge engineering and medicine. And we would like to talk to you about it. And I said, well, okay. You know, I'll talk to you about it and I'll help you. Then so I came to talk, and then they said, well, what we really want is for you to do it, for you to lead it. And I said, well,
that's the best.
We can talk. Not likely, but we can talk. But you know, they convinced me. So it was like we have bought this new building. Spent over $100,000 to acquire this new bank building, 17-story, right in the Texas Medical Center. It'll be in partnership with Houston Methodist Hospital. And you know, you are the person in the country who we think could make this happen. And I said, well, it is a continuation of the path I've been on all along. So that's how I ended up in Houston. And just this past May, we graduated our first class, Robert. And I will end on this. So this is what I'm doing now. I started a medical school that converges engineering and medicine in the same curriculum. The students graduate in 4 years, like they do in every other medical school, but with two degrees, an MD degree and a master's in engineering innovation. And each student is required to invent a solution to a healthcare problem. All of our students are required to invent a solution to a healthcare problem. Our whole goal is to train medical problem solvers and innovators. That's who we're training. We're training medical innovators. That's the purpose. That is what's distinctive about us. The name of the program is called ENMED, ENMED, for Engineering Medicine.
Got it.
It's a collaboration between A&M and Houston Methodist Hospital. Houston Methodist is on the U.S. News and World Report honor roll as one of the top 20 hospitals in the country in the medical center. That is what I'm doing now. We graduated our first class this past May. The graduation was applauded broadly across the nation to the point that we were able to have a celebratory colloquium that featured five Nobel laureates, the inventor of the internet, and a session moderated by the president emerita of MIT, who's Susan Hockfield. That was our coming out party.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Hey, listen, how about that, man?
No, that's right. Well, you know, I have to say that first of all, I got smarter as a result of this interview. So I want to tell you that you made me much smarter than I was before this interview, for sure. But it's not lost on me that the key figure in your life, as you sort of say, teacher, Mrs. Burke, you've come a full circle. You are inspiring now young people to understand that the science that brings forth new knowledge that actually impacts people's lives matters, and that it's not just the people in population science that it's their responsible. It's us too.
Yeah, that's right.
At the basic level. So thank you.
And every day I go into a school and I see these kids, you know, I light up and I tell them, and like I told the graduates, each of you in your own way can be a difference maker. Whether it's in a private practice or the CEO of a startup, be a difference maker. Your calling is to make a difference in the lives of all of us around you and those to follow you. Be a difference maker. So that's my mantra, man.
Man, listen, you don't drop the, ain't nothing to say after that. You don't drop the mic.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, a podcast of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.